A very good evening to all of you that are here. I appreciate that you guys are here, and I do hope that you'll engage. We are going for an hour, which is quite a short amount of time considering the topic. I'd like to welcome everyone who's going to be watching this episode on YouTube, and I'd like to thank the podcast party, and I'd like to thank the series Democracy Unplugged for what it's trying to achieve, not just for us in the room, but for all patriotic South Africans and everyone who has a vested interest in South Africa. The brief that we've been given, which is, I won't lie, it made me very anxious, very nervous, because people's lives actually get taken, is this topic of this illicit economy and an underground economy. I did get this brief from Sia and the team, Rina and everyone. So what I'm reading now is not from me. It's not my brilliance. Billions of rands slip through South Africa's fingers through a thriving shadow economy that fuels crime and inequality, amongst others. From things like illegal mining to counterfeit goods, cigarette smuggling to state capture networks, the illicit economy is eating away at our future. I just did a basic search, and just illicit cigarettes alone are close to 30 billion a year in lost taxes. Gold, what we call amazamazama on their own, there are rumors of about 30,000 illegal miners, and that's about 70 billion a year that's lost. And then our counterfeit economy, I mean, those of you that shop from, I won't mention, that is over 100 billion rand a year, just in some type of an underground economy. Where this money goes, who ends up with it in their pockets, what it's actually funding is kind of scary. I'd like to introduce my panelists, and I'd like to welcome them very much. I hope you guys don't mind. I will be reading your profiles. I'll try and be as brief as I can be, because, Babu Mate, yours is quite scary. I'll start with David. This one is short and sweet, and it's to the point, unlike the other guys. David Onsaro, to my left, is the chief executive of the Free Market Foundation, a classical liberal think tank, which is headquartered in Johannesburg in South Africa. Prior to this, he was the chief operating officer at the Center for Risk Analysis of the Institute of Race Relations. He has over 15 years of experience working in think tanks, consultancies, and trade associations. He's a strong advocate for individual liberty and market-based approaches to public policy, a very aggressive capitalist. David holds a master's degree in political science from the University of Cape Town. Please may you give him a hand. Next to David, we've got Uputi Nomubaba. I apologize, you look very fresh. I've heard you've run a few comrades marathons, so you never know. Uputi Nomubaba Khulekani Mate is the CEO of Business Unity South Africa, a position he's held since the beginning of this year. Before joining BUSA, he was the head of financial inclusion at the Banking Association of Africa, of South Africa, BASA, where he focused on driving transformation in the banking industry, fostering small business development and promoting financial education. An experienced policy development professional, Umate has held various roles in public service, including positions in the presidency, the National Planning Commission Secretariat, and the Department of Planning, Monitoring, and Evaluation. Notably, during his time in the National Planning Commission Secretariat, he played a significant role in developing the National Development Plan and served as the head of the Secretariat. Early in his career, Umate spent 15 years in the education sector, specializing in adult education, something that I believe is very close to his heart. He led the Thembalethu Community Education Center, which gained national and international recognition for its outstanding work, earning two national awards and one international award. In 2007, he was appointed chairman of the ministerial committee tasked with reviewing adult education policy in South Africa and contributed to the establishment and governance of the Education, Training and Development CETA. Umate is a certified director and a member of the Institute of Directors of South Africa. He holds a Master's of Science degree in Development Finance and a Master of Education degree focusing on adult education. I'm almost done. Additionally, he is a fellow of the African Leadership Initiative, part of the Aspen Global Leadership Network, and an alumnus of the Ford Foundation International Fellowship Program. He serves on the board of directors of the IGUSASA Student Financial Aid Program Foundation and was recently appointed to the boards of the Human Resources Development Council and the National Education Collaboration Trust. All of this after running more than 10 comrades marathons. It's not a lot of stuff. Please give a hand to Khulekani Mate. Last but not least, Mr. Chair Thomas has asked to be excused at 7. So if we're still going in advance, please may you excuse him because he does have a prior engagement. If not, I'm hoping we'll have wrapped up by then. Chair Thomas is the CEO of the IRS Forensic Investigations Company, an independent financial and organized crimes investigation company. He has over 32 years as a veteran of security and law enforcement in South Africa. He holds a postgraduate certificate in international criminal law from the Mandela Institute at the Wits School of Law, a certificate in corporate fraud management from the South Africa Institute of Corporate Fraud Management, various courses in combating fraud and corruption from the University of Pretoria, has completed the corporate and ethics governance program at the University of Pretoria, as well as the POPIA program at the University of Pretoria. He holds a diploma in security management from DMS. Chad was previously the general manager of Stallion Investigations, a division of Stallion Security. And prior to that, he was head of investigations for BOE Private Bank in insurance and FG, that division. And before that, head of security at Standard Bank Property Fund Managers. Chad has served in an investigation and intelligence capacity in the permanent force of the South African National Defense Force until the end of 1994 and remained an active member of the Reserve Force until 2008. He is the recipient of the Security Industry's 2019 Bravery Award, as well as the Security Industry Gold Medal for Bravery, awarded in 1998. He was nominated for the Mail and Guardian Drivers of Change Award in 2008. A warm round of applause, please, for Chad Thomas. The reason I'm nervous is because we're dealing with a lot as a country. And I'm one of those people that's always hesitant to only discuss negative things. But it seems like a lot of them are exploding everywhere. We had the KZN Police Commissioner, General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi, coming to the fore and speaking about a drug cartel in South Africa that has infiltrated the judiciary at the highest levels, our politicians at the highest levels. This would lead to a leave of absence by the police minister or of the police minister, Senzo Mchunu. We currently have an acting police minister. As of, I don't know if today or yesterday, the Deputy National Commissioner, Shadrach Sibiya, has been suspended officially by the National Commissioner of Police, Fani Masemola. There's a commission, the Madlanga Commission, which is going to be headed by a retired constitutional justice, Umbuyiseli Madlanga, to look into this and probe into this. Parliament have requested Mkhwanazi to come back to account, which he says he's done before and he's kind of busy. There have been issues with case dockets that have gone back and forth. We've got ongoing issues from back in the day. Cape Flats and the drugs. Rumors of terrorism in places like Mozambique. The chief of the SANDF, General Rudzani Mapwanya, visiting Iran, which caused a stir at some point. There's a documentary that's come out on Netflix of Thabo Best and Unandipa, Dr. Nandipa Makutumana. And there's a case now of Vusikhet Matlala. There's a lot going on. And it feeds into all of this, which speaks to this underground economy, where the money goes, what happens. I'm going to be going through each of our panelists to just ask their views and their opinions on this topic. Once I've heard from them, I'll maybe ask any questions. And if we still have time, I'll go around again and then open up to the floor. David, I think we'll start with you, sir.
Well, I think it's an inappropriate point to start with me because I'm not a security or crime expert. But I'm a policy analyst and I look at policy through the lens of individual freedom. And my organization, the Free Market Foundation, our bias is towards free market capitalism, as you mentioned. But that's not just the free exchange and free enterprise. It's also about the role of government and the rule of law and other things like private property rights. And so when we think of, okay, what is the core function of the state? Like if we strip it down to its first principles, what are the basic requirements for a government to function in a free society and uphold people's rights? So really it's three things. It's the protection of life, liberty, and property. So the protection of life is to prevent people from inflicting harm on one another, killing one another, or assaulting, or doing other sorts of violent acts upon one another. That's internally, but also externally as well. So from external threats to the sovereignty of the country. So protecting life. Protecting liberty is your freedom to express yourself, your freedom to associate with whomever you want, your freedom to start a business, to start a political party, your freedom to articulate your ideas of the world, to associate with whatever religious or other civil society grouping you want. And then to protect your property. So as individuals, we are endowed with inalienable rights of ownership, and your property is intrinsically yours. You have a claim over it. Sometimes there's a dispute over the property, and then you need an impartial adjudicator like the courts to mediate or moderate these disputes. So life, liberty, and property. That's the foundation of the state. That is very different to what we have in South Africa at the moment and in many other countries in the world, including in the Western world where these ideas of liberty originated. So what we have in South Africa is actually the state, and this is kind of a paradox, is increasingly incapable of performing those basic functions. So as you alluded to in the beginning, we have rampant criminality, very high levels of violent crime, very high levels of sexual crimes. We have infringements of those rights to life, liberty, and property on a daily basis in South Africa. And we can go through the numbers. But on the other hand, we have this very expansive state that overregulates many features of our daily interactions and our economic life, and which is overbearing and creates a lot of rules and processes which actually stifle free enterprise, freedom of choice, and the other basic freedoms that are inherent to us as individuals. So you mentioned zamazamas. I think that's a very good example. In South Africa, since the 1990s, the South African state has taken over mineral rights in South Africa. So if you are a miner, you have to apply to the government for permission to mine. So even if you're the owner of a property, you still need a mining license from the state. And the state can withhold that license for arbitrary reasons, like black economic empowerment, for example, is one of the conditions. If you're not deemed to be transformed, sorry, you can't mine. There's other CSI obligations, all of these other things that impose this burden on miners. And then what happens? Many traditional mining companies are forced to close down or go offshore, and this leaves this void. And what rushes in to fill the void? Illegal mining, so-called illegal mining. So that shows that there is a demand-supply tension. There's obviously still demand for South African minerals like gold, and the criminals see that opportunity and they go and they exploit that. And that is a direct consequence of the incentive structure that has been put in place by the government that is creating this problem. If we had a more liberalized mining sector, we wouldn't have the Zama-Zama problem. We'd have much more revenue from mining sales and exports, and we would actually have a flourishing mining sector. But at the moment, you know, look at the gang violence between the Zama-Zamas, etc., a lot of illicit trade, that's what's driving that aberrant behavior. So it's the same with the tobacco industry. We now have the Tobacco Products and Electronic Delivery Systems Control Bill, which is seeking to ban the use of tobacco products in places like restaurants and other places of work. There's massive taxes on cigarette consumption. So if you look at the legal cigarettes, a box of 20 cigarettes will cost you between 25 Rand and 60 Rand. But illegal cigarettes, which are a direct consequence of state action because of things like the tobacco ban during COVID, those are far cheaper. Those are between 5 Rand and 20 Rand. So if you're a low-income consumer or even just a middle-class consumer, you're faced with this choice, and naturally you're going to the cheaper options because that's what people seek. But a lot of that tobacco sales is non-revenue generating for the state. And as we know, the government's in this fiscal hole, hundreds of billions of rands fiscal deficit. I think it's about 390 billion rand deficit. So the state is spending way more money than it's generating in terms of revenue. And so it's shooting itself in the foot. So I think when we have this discussion, we should have as a backdrop a question in our minds as to what are the policy choices that the government of national unity is making that are actually incentivizing these kinds of behaviors. So there's a lot of calls, oh, no, we need more aggressive policing, we need better enforcement. As we know, SAPS can barely get its head out of a paper bag. And also there's a lot of corruption and infiltration of criminal syndicates into SAPS itself. So us asking the police to enforce better, to be more efficient, go after these syndicates, yeah, maybe that might at some level be the right thing to do, but ultimately you're ignoring the upstream causes of a lot of these problems.
Thank you, David. Before we go to Khulekani, would you argue that, or rather, do you solely blame the state from a policy perspective? As someone who advocates for the free market, do you place any blame on business? Because you've got big minds, for example, that maybe fund some of this regulation that makes it difficult for smaller players, and even in the tobacco industry as well. Because, I mean, from a state perspective, as you said, they don't benefit from illicit cigarettes. And the issue becomes the bigger guys who are like, well, we pay taxes. We want the laws to be like this. So I'm just asking, do you only blame the state? Do you think business has a role? Sorry, that's for you, David. I'm sorry.
Oh, for me.
My apologies. Oh, I said before we go to Khulekani, sorry.
Now you're going to have to repeat the question.
My apologies.
No. Look, I think incumbent firms, and many, like if you look at, for example, the telecommunications sector, they do benefit from an incumbency advantage where they have more regulations which prohibit market entry from their competitors. But I mean, if you look at the tobacco industry as just one example, you know, the illicit market has expanded from, I have some figures here, when we look at the COVID ban, the 5-month COVID ban, the illicit market then was about 30 to 35% of all tobacco consumption. It's now risen to about 2/3, to about between 60 and 70%, which really represents a complete hollowing out of the traditional market. And so, yeah, I mean, you have this kind of quite hypocritical approach from the government, which says, oh, no, we're just motivated by public health concerns, and we want to encourage people to stop smoking, so we're going to come with our big hammer, we're going to have lots of taxes. Bear in mind, there's a excise tax of about 22 rand per box of cigarettes. So, I mean, earlier I said the cheap cigarettes, the illicit ones, cost you, the consumer, between 5 rand and 20 rand. And the minimum collectible tax, the MCT, that's about 25 rand if you include VAT, consumption tax, on that. So that's the base that all of these traditional formerly dominant tobacco companies are having to pay over 25 rand out of, say, a maximum of 60 rand per box to the government. So they're getting hammered really hard by this. And why I say the state is being hypocritical is because they're motivated by supposedly the health of the populace, but actually what they're doing is they're driving consumers towards these other options, which maybe don't have the same levels of quality control, health standards that are being included in those products. You don't know what the constitution of these products are. So, I mean, I'm, and my organization, the Free Market Foundation, is an advocate of minimal regulation. But what we can also see is firms that offer consumer products have an incentive themselves to be transparent about the composition of their products. There's a strong tradition of self-regulation in many of these sectors. And I think that should be the approach. Kind of voluntary disclosures of information rather than trying to aggressively target these firms and actually create these other aberrant problems that our police force is just not able to deal with.
Thank you, David. Khulekani, I'm not sure if you'd fully agree as Business Unity South Africa. Do you also think maybe the state is to blame mostly? Do you see a role that business is meant to play in this space?
So Thanks, panel, and good evening, everybody. Really fascinating to be part of this conversation, because it is really important that we address this problem. It is a problem that affects everybody. It's kind of everybody's enemy, including those who think that they are benefiting from it. Let me tell you a short story. So I live in Jozini. Does anybody know where Jozini is? You don't. Which is on the north coast of KZN.
Not Jozini.
No.
Almost. Jozini.
Jozini. Almost. Almost, David.
Yesodwana.
Yesodwana. So that's where the village where I come from is. It's about 100 kilometers away from the border, Mozambique on the one side, and give or take 50 kilometers from the Eswatini border. It can be shorter if you just jump and don't go through the border gate. Around 2014, there was a point when people who owned vehicles in that village could not sleep at home with their vehicles, so you couldn't park your car in the garage or in your yard and go to sleep, because as sure as hell it would be taken away from you overnight, cross the border to Mozambique, and it's gone. So people had to, before they go to sleep, they had to drive some 5, 10, 15, 20 kilometers to the nearest police station, park their vehicles overnight, hop in a taxi to go back home to sleep, and repeat that in the morning to go and collect their vehicles. Why was that the case? Because there was pretty much no police enforcement and sort of security to make sure that people's properties were protected. So the point that David was making. Fast forward a bit. 2021, I just happened to be at home in the village when the July unrest happened. And I saw something that still shocks me today, because people I lived among for a very long time were calling each other to go and loot the shops and so on, and burn things down, and you know, as soon as I've taken everything, that burn stuff down. It took about 3 days, give or take, before the police could come and take control of that situation and be in charge. Until then, it was chaos. I tried to leave the house to go and see what was happening. Local young man said to me, "Taima, don't go. We're warning you, we know you're a nice man, don't go, because you won't be able to come back." So I say these things just to make a point that when the government, which we give the responsibility to protect us, we give them the right to use force as long as they protect us, when they're absent, a whole lot of things can go wrong. So I started wondering in those days, I know I'm wasting your time, panel, I started wondering, how long would it take a government, the police, to find out if somebody crossed any of these borders into these villages, mow down 100 people and go back? It would probably take a couple of days before they know what's unfolding. And that is what we're dealing with, because whether you are talking about the Zamazamas or the illicit goods that go through our borders, helped through the borders by the fact that through corruption and lack of enforcement, nobody, you know, people will accept a bribe and let these goods through. That is how weak our state has become in protecting us as citizens, in protecting our property, in protecting businesses, and so on. And so when you come to the illicit economy specifically, it is an enemy of businesses, because businesses, legitimate businesses, suffer when they have to compete with these other operators who are not subject to any form of regulation, who pay no taxes, who are not under any scrutiny. So as businesses, we suffer. But consumers also suffer. They might think that they're getting a bargain, 5 rand instead of whatever, 25 rand, or whatever the number is. I don't smoke, so I don't know these things. Or you know, cheap alcohol, X number instead of Y, and they think they're getting a bargain. But these things have massive, massive health risks for consumers, right down to the clothes people wear, the pharmaceuticals that are available through these sort of illicit channels. All of these affect consumers. And many people die out of consuming these products that are not healthy. And then, of course, the government. So the government, you've given out the numbers, loses hundreds of billions in lost revenue to this activity. And I'm saying this just to make the point that it's not a case of one sector of the economy is benefiting from this and therefore is acting in a particular way, right? Because all of us lose out in this. And we lose out because the government, the responsibility we give to the government to protect us through putting appropriate regulations in place, enforcing those regulations and making sure that everybody plays by the same rules, that does not happen. We can argue with David whether, you know, those levels of regulations are required or not. It's a different conversation, and I don't want to be distracted by that. But we do need a government in place that can perform its basic function. If it doesn't, we all lose in one form or the other. And so when you say, does business benefit from that, from all of this? No. I mean, I know of different sectors that, as an organized business formation, that have come to us and saying, we are hemorrhaging. We're about to close down because we're competing with these unseen operators. We know the numbers. We know what we used to make before, in some instances, in the case of cigarettes and alcohol. We know the numbers of what we used to make before COVID. We don't believe that South Africans have suddenly become saints. They smoke less, they drink less. So clearly something is happening. The government hasn't been able to clamp down on that and make sure that everybody plays by the same rules. We can argue about those rules, whether they are appropriate or not, but at least let's all play by those rules. We're not, and this is why this is a serious problem. Of course, firms, large and small, are affected by regulations differently. We know this. We know that big firms are likely to get in a room with unions, bargain until they arrive at some sort of wage settlement, right? That wage settlement might be affordable to larger firms and completely unaffordable to smaller firms. So, of course, there will be those instances where something that is agreed to by one sector of the economy has the negative effect on the other sector. But it's not because somebody goes out of their way to say, we benefit from this and therefore let's do this. It really is a case of businesses looking for the better of two evils that they're faced with.
Thank you, Kuleran. Before I go to Chad, I'd just like you to touch on two points. The high income inequality we have as a country, which would then push the mainstream or the mass consumer to want to buy cheaper products, which are not good for them. The second one is undocumented people in the country. To what you're saying, people coming in, we don't know who they are. They take things or they bring things in. We can't track who they are and where they're from. Do you have any solutions, anything you think we should be discussing in that regard?
So I think we've reached a point just in terms of, let's start with hard infrastructure. We've allowed things to break down to a level that to try and get back to where we were before we talk about even creating more infrastructure assets is going to take the amount of money we don't have for different reasons, right? One of which is the fact that obviously we are, as a country, also over indebted. We've borrowed ourselves to the kilt. And so government can't afford to borrow more to finance infrastructure upgrades, to finance infrastructure maintenance that is required. In the same way, we've also lost capacity, human capacity, for government to just perform its basic functions. So in many ways, to really solve the multiplicity of the problems that we face today, not the least of which is crime and corruption, does require collaboration between various sectors because it affects us all. And we've started with some of this collaboration around trying to see how business can support the fight against crime and corruption. Still early stages, and I don't want to claim victories too early, but the point I'm making is that it's going to need collaboration for us. If we just leave it to government, what I've described to you early is just going to get worse.
Okay.
If we leave it to government alone.
Okay, thank you. Chad, from your side, do you have any solutions? I've watched some of your interviews. You're quite clued up on some of the characters that are involved in a lot of the some of the really criminal syndicates that we have as a country. Are there any solutions? Some guys are like, less state intervention, maybe the regulations are not working that well. From your side, as someone with experience in the space, security, crime, etc., are there any solutions? Is there any hope?
Thank you for inviting me. It's my first podcast, so the podcast cherry's popped. So, yeah. There's so much to unpack when it comes to crime in South Africa, when it comes to the state of South Africa. Before we get to the bad, I want to emphasize the good. We wouldn't have had a national election resulting in a GNU if our country had been captured and if our country was a failed state. We wouldn't be preparing for local elections next year if we were a failed country and if the state had been captured. We have a fiercely independent media. We wouldn't be able to sit here if we were in certain other countries discussing the problems that we face in our country. We have fiercely independent Chapter 9 institutions. But we've got massive problems, and those problems are old. Our problems in South Africa, in my opinion, and I want to qualify that's in my opinion, date back to 1999. We came out of a period of Mandela Fourier. There was a lot of foreign investment. We couldn't believe that we had succeeded in 1994 without massive bloodshed in coming together, as Tutu phrased, the Rainbow Nation. And things were looking really good for us. And this is where it becomes controversial, and that's why there was the caveat that this is my personal opinion. And Mbeki comes into power mid-99, and in December 99, the arms deal is signed into effect. By the early 2000s, Judge Willem Heath, the late Judge Heath, has resigned from the SIU because he says he identified there being problems within the arms deal, which at that time was the biggest procurement deal in South African history. And the president, because the SIU worked on presidential proclamation, wouldn't allow him to investigate these issues that had been discovered within the arms deal. Remember, Zuma wasn't in power as yet in 99 when that deal was signed. Everybody thinks Zuma was the arms deal. He wasn't. The whole reason Zuma's on trial for the arms deal is because much later, Shabir Sheikh was identified as being close to him, and when Thales in France wanted to have some or other political cover should they be investigated because the arms deal was corrupt, they needed somebody to cover for them. And that's where that whole 500,000 rand bribe came in with the encrypted facts. But it was never Zuma that signed the arms deal into effect. It was Mbeki, December 1999. It was also Mbeki in 2000 that appointed the first non-career police officer, a political appointment, as the Commissioner of Police, Jackie Selebi. We all know what happened there. So 25 years ago, Jackie Selebi becomes Commissioner of Police. Why? Why do we suddenly have a political cadre as the head of our law enforcement? What happened in the arms deal at the end of 1999? What were we being set up for going forward? So when we talk about state capture didn't start with Zuma, it didn't start with the Gupta. State capture started in December 1999. It started with the arms deal. We all know that there were massive problems in terms of the arms deal, with the offtakes, with the agreements, with the training that should have taken place in South Africa, with what those companies that took billions of rands out of our fiscus, those arms dealing companies, should have given back to us, which we didn't get back. But certain people benefited, and it's easy to blame the dead Joe Modise. Can't. There's other people that benefited that we will find out eventually. Maybe they'll be dead by then, but we will find out. And since then, we've had this hollowing out of organizations that are so very important and critical to fighting crime. You had the police force of the early 90s become the police service in 95, which was meant to become far more community orientated. Fast forward to the 2000s, when Becky Cele takes over as Commissioner of Police, he decides to go back to a police force. He introduces the Amabereta, and he becomes very aggressive. We go from having civilian ranks of directors and commissioners to generals and brigadiers. So he can be a generalissimo. He can have all these ranks on him. He can be a proper general and a despot. So they go to start wearing berets. It becomes a very strange environment. We have all these issues that follow Paulo Kwane, the blood on the dance floor in 2009. We then have a caretaker president, and this is what worries me about our caretaker minister, Feroz Khachalia, because caretakers are meant to be caretakers in an acting position, and no matter what anybody says about Kalim Mohlantle, he was in an acting position. They had got rid of Mbeki, they wanted to insert Zuma, but there was this whole issue they needed to sort out. So Kalim Mohlantle was inserted, and what does he do? He disbands the Scorpions. He loves to brag about what a great president he was at the time, but he disbanded the Scorpions, one of the key crime-fighting organizations in our country. So Kalamu Klantli does us no favors, as much as he likes to present himself as having done us favors. We now have the Hawks, and they're talking about wanting to replace the Hawks, disband the Hawks, have IDAC as Scorpion 2.0. It's not going to work. The Hawks are there to do something, and the Hawks should be able to do something. And the Hawks, committed resources, have had success. They've never been more than 50% odd capacitated. Imagine that. The Hawks received 2% of the police budget, which was 100 billion rand per annum. It's now gone up to 129 billion rand per annum. They get 2% of the police budget to fight priority crime in South Africa. Conversely, VIP protection services and security services within the police get 3.5% of the budget, almost double that of the Hawks. So where are our priorities? So of course we're going to have a flourishing illicit economy. Of course we're going to become one of the main transshipment points in the world. For narcotics, for trafficking in humans, for trafficking in endangered species. It's an unbelievable situation we find ourselves in. We've had generals accused of some of the worst crimes and found guilty. We had General Glooley, head of crime intelligence. He's serving a sentence. We had General Joe Mabaso, whose wife was a business partner to Radovan Krecher. How bizarre is that? He was part of the crime intelligence component. We haven't had a commissioner serve out his full term since Jackie Celebi's days. It's unbelievable that in 25 years we've survived as a country, considering the fact that our police force has been decimated. We've got such a deficit of leadership at the top that it has caused a fractured police force. But let's go back to what I began with. We've survived. Somehow, look at the July 2021 unrest. That could have spread, but somehow through collaboration with the state law enforcement agencies and the private sector security industry, we were able to prevent it from spreading. We've been able to have free and fair elections. And of course they've been fair elections. We wouldn't have a GNU if they weren't fair. We wouldn't have had the ruling party with a significant majority drop to around 40%. So somewhere along the line, we haven't given up as a nation. There's energy. We want to see this country thrive. We love this country. And I think we need to figure out what it is that we're still doing right that we haven't completely collapsed. Because everything has been there for a quarter of a century to put us into failed state status. We rank in the top five most violent criminal societies in the world, and two of the countries we share that top five honor with are Haiti and Afghanistan. Yet we're sitting here today, we're driving through Sandton, we've got skyscrapers. Yeah, we've got potholes, we've got water issues, electricity issues, but we're sitting here. So somewhere along the line, we're doing something right. Let's try to find out what that is Let's try to capitalize on that. We can't change anything overnight. Short term, nothing's going to happen. Medium to long term, we need to start thinking about the next generation. We owe it to them.
Thank you so much, Chad. We don't have time. Quick questions, please. One question per person.
Penril, I'm one of the guys that are always swearing at you on social media.
There's a lot of you, don't worry.
Because you say one thing that's like a 100% correct, and the next day I'm like, what is he saying this time? But that's how people feel about me as well in general, as a political player, activist, and so forth. But yeah, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you to Podcast Party for organizing this conversation and the topic, SA's illicit economy. As I'm talking to you right now, I must confess that I, at this current conjuncture in my life, am someone that has no problems with the illicit economy. I'll tell you why, because I grew up in a very sort of privileged family, well-educated. Some used to even call me a cheese boy. As you can see, I'm wearing like Versace. It's like 20 years
Thank you, Lindsay.
Old.
Please keep it short, sir. I'm
still wearing it. But in a nutshell, what I'm trying to say is that we find ourselves as normal South Africans tired of, you know, holding a higher moral standard than what our leaders ourselves are willing to do. Why should we not be illicit in how we do business if our own very own president has got Rama dollars underneath his couch? Why must we not buy that one rand illegal cigarette if, you know, the president himself is even immoral to go as far as even saying what he said yesterday, that his own political party is not good enough, others are good enough. So I think in essence, in short, what I'm trying to say is that our moral decay is just so bad. Corruption is so high in this nation that no one is good anymore. Whose responsibility is it to remind us of our spirituality, if that's what it is? Who is it going to remind us of our God principle, our ancestral principles, or whatever it was that kept us honest as South Africans? So
as far as
we do not have that in line, our SA's illicit economy in general will continue to suffer. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That was a comment. Question? Don't be like Lincoln. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ntlanhlang Kala. I'm not a cheese boy. I'm from the Kasi, as Kasi as it comes. I just wanted to know a quick question. Do you think the government is orchestrating these problems so that they benefit from these problems? Somewhere around COVID, I don't know which minister, they found a truck belonging to her with all of these illicit cigarettes. So I just want to find out, if is this an intentional thing that the government is doing according to your belief? And then if you are president for a term, what would you do differently?
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Next question.
Evening, everybody. And thanks to the Podcast Party again for having this discussion. Very simple question. Minimum wage is about 4,700 rand per month. A kilo of cocaine is 400,000 rand.
How do you know this thing?
Anyway.
Let us
but
know.
The illicit economy is massive. We know this. And in the context of minimum wage as a policy from the government, amidst 33% real unemployment rate and this massive illicit economy, because no one in the illicit economy is paying tax, no one's officially employed. How would the three of you guys view that relationship in respect of reducing unemployment in South Africa against the backdrop of this massive illicit economy? That's my question.
Thank you. Please pass it on. We'll start answering some of the questions. Please just hold the mic. I think we'll just go this way, but if you feel the energy, please feel free to engage. Question is asked, do you think government is doing this on purpose because they benefit? I mean, if ministers are being found with trucks with illicit goods. David, you're shifting very quickly. Kulegan, I don't know if you want to give it a chance.
I don't think so. I know that things are not great, but I don't think that I've worked for the government. I've sat in and listened in cabinet meetings. I've never been a cabinet member. And that was over a period of 10 years. There isn't a government decision that says, well, let's allow these things to happen. So to the extent that people like some people in government, even senior people in government, are found in the wrong, it's just because we really have lost our moral compass, but not because it's government who benefits from that and does these things deliberately. It is individual greed, okay. Is my view.
Thank you. Well, I mean, the point was made earlier about cadre deployment, and I think that that is the politicization of the civil service, which includes the police. And I think that that is not a bug. It's a feature of the ANC's model of governance. 1997, Nelson Mandela, who many people love and venerate, he specifically directed the ANC to follow a policy of cadre deployment. Thabo Mbeki energetically implemented that. There were many things that Thabo Mbeki did well in terms of macroeconomic policy, but that was the beginning of the rot. So, and it's very hard to put the genie back into the bottle once you've let it out. So I'm not surprised that we haven't had the commissioner finish his term and that we have this interlocking web of criminal syndicates and political interests. It's because the incentives are there to abuse that power and authority. So that's why I would say that we actually need to decentralize policing and start wrestling power away from the center, because the center can no longer hold. And I think we've had, from Chad, a catalogue of just how deep the criminalization of the police force is. And to me, my response is, well, look at what happened during the July 2021 riots. That was an abject failure of the state. For how long? 3 days before the police arrived. And who was it? It was private security, but also individuals, community groups that came together, used armed force, so they had private small arms, to push back the tide of those criminal mobs that were threatening to destroy, and in many cases did destroy, the livelihoods of many thousands of people. To the tune of billions and billions, I think it was like 50 billion rand was the losses there, which I think was in the top 10 of riots in terms of the financial cost in the 21st century. I think I read that somewhere. So, I mean, Mayor Jordan Hill Lewis in Cape Town, he has said that we need to devolve policing functions, and there are steps in that direction. So there's the Law Enforcement Advancement Program. The president has admitted that the DA's governance model is superior to the ANC's governance model. I wouldn't say that that means that the DA's model is perfect. But the mayor of Cape Town, Hill Lewis, is saying, well, we need to amend its Section 64EC of the SAPS Act to allow Metro Police not only to prevent crime, but also to investigate crime. So he wants "and investigate" to be added to the SAPS Act. Seems like a good idea, but we have a parliament which is dominated by the ANC with about 40%, plus the EFF and MK, which are ideologically opposed to decentralization. They see that as a threat to state power. So I would encourage...
I've been asked to move on, sorry.
I would encourage the mayor
you
to
You prefer the DA further. And you no. support decentralization of the police?
No, but they must do it. They must not wait for permission. They must go ahead and take control of policing functions in the Western Cape. Because if you wait, you have blood on your hands, because people are dying in these communities in the Cape Flats. So, and preventing crime, you can interpret broadly. It's to say, well, we need to actually take measures in terms of forensics, in terms of proper investigative capacities. And so if the national police object to that, they can fight you in the courts. There's in law a principle, the doctrine of necessity. There's imminent peril facing the communities of the Western Cape, and the Western Cape government and the city of Cape Town need to act to defend the vital interests of those communities. So that's what I mean by taking power involuntarily away from the center, because as we've seen, the SAPS is fundamentally compromised. It's not just like inefficient or a bit incapacitated. It is fundamentally compromised. And we have a higher duty to protect the fundamental rights of the citizens of this country. And that requires some real politic, some Machiavellian politics, to say we're going to acquire these powers and fight us in the courts, and
thank you, David.
We're going to serve our constituents.
Chad, I don't know if you'd like to take Xavier's question about how much a kg of cocaine costs and the incentive versus minimum wage.
I'm going to keep it very short. Yeah. The eloquent gentleman took up a bit of time there. To your point about people in government benefiting from crime, yes, there are people, there are bad actors. Are people turning a blind eye to it, or are they complicit? I would say there's a lot of members of government who are complicit, and members of parties that are complicit, because when you've got people engaging in the illicit economy, if one looks at so-called business forums, which is a classy name for mafias, construction mafias and water tanker mafias and other types of mafias, the money's going back somewhere. We talk about the arms deal. We heard that a certain political party benefited from the arms deal. We talk about Katie Molefe with his relationship with Vusikat Mthlala, Vusikat Mthlala's relationship with the other tenderpreneurs at the Tembisa Hospital. We look how the Tembisa Hospital was plundered to the tune of 850 million rand. There's no way that people didn't know what was going on. Yeah, you've got these guys living La Vida Loca. You've got them buying the greater sports cars, mansions. They're wearing Versace like this gentleman here. But somebody else is turning a blind eye. And are they turning a blind eye because it's going into their pocket, or is it going into their party political coffers to fund electioneering or to fund congresses or national committee meetings? I don't know. But to answer your question, yes, there is complicity. There are bad actors within government. People know who those bad actors are, but they're turning a blind eye. Whether they're doing it deliberately or not, we're going to find out as we go forward.
Thank you, Chad. The question from Xavier, sorry. Minimum wage?
Cocaine.
Cocaine.
Sure, look, we sit geographically as one of the most important countries in the world. That's the whole reason the Dutch East India Company established a refueling station of sorts in 1652. With what's going on in the Middle East, if the Suez Canal is closed off, South Africa again can benefit, if our ports can function, from the fact that we are geographically so incredibly important. On our West Coast, we're bringing in drugs from South America, cocaine. It's been repackaged in South Africa. On our East Coast, we're bringing in heroin that's grown in Afghanistan. It goes to Pakistan, to Dar es Salaam, Maputo to South Africa, repackaged. Why is it repackaged here? Why are we such a massive transshipment point? Because we've got good infrastructure still. We've got a good export market. So where do our drugs go? Our drugs aren't for local consumption. Our drugs go to Australia. One of the biggest suppliers of drugs to Australia is via South Africa. Whether it's cocaine, whether it's methamphetamine, it comes from South Africa. Heroin comes from South Africa. You have this nexus of criminal syndicates that are working together. They have to launder that money. They have to enjoy that money. They have to try and introduce that money into the mainstream economy. So you've got the enablers. You've got the accountants. You've got the lawyers. You've got people that are creating the businesses for them. You've got the front companies that have to launder the money. So whether it's a barbershop, a salon, a bar, a restaurant, a church, that's one of the biggest laundries at the moment, are churches. So when you're earning 4,700 a month and you're in Ikasi, where this gentleman's from, not like the cheese man, and you see somebody living it up, who do you aspire to be? Do you aspire to be the public servant who battles and gets up early every morning to use public transport to go to work at the hospital? Or do you want to be the gangster who's got the chicks, he's got the car, he's got the jewelry, he's living the suave life? So to your point, sir, from a moral perspective, there's massive decay.
Thank you. I'm going to take two questions. We may not answer them because I'd like them to close off in the interest of time. Just two questions. Okay. Please keep it short.
Okay, good evening. My first question is for David and my second one is for Chad. David, you mentioned a liberal approach, and considering that government seems to like a stricter approach, I wanted to ask you what your recommendations are in terms of liberal approach towards illicit markets that you would make to government. And for Chad, I just wanted to find out what your opinion is on the private security companies carrying out the jobs of police and what the potential future consequences could be, such as the breakdown in relationship or trust between the public and the police services.
Thank you. One more hand.
My question's for Chad. You mentioned earlier that we have an independent press and independent Chapter 9 institutions. How well rated would you put them? So I get the sense that mainstream media tends to be a government lapdog often. They'll be critical around corruption issues, but when it comes to government policy, they can't say enough nice things despite the fact that the policy has ruined the nation. We don't really see a diversity of opinions expressed in the press. There was almost no pushback on the ICJ case that was launched by the state, which is ruining our relationship with the Americans. So I sort of don't think we really have an independent press. And I've been told as much by journalists who've told me that there's juniorization in the newsroom, there's political bias, and there's probably outright bribery. And then when it comes to Chapter 9 institutions, it doesn't seem that the Human Rights Commission applies its standards in an even manner. They've effectively said that the race of the speaker will be factored into whether they punish that person or not. And I don't think many people in this room could name many of the other Chapter 9 institutions because they're basically moribund. So I think you might be being overly optimistic on that front.
Thank you very much. I'd like each of you gentlemen to please close. Feel free to answer any of the questions or not. David, we can start with you.
So a liberal approach to policing is one which prioritizes the rights of citizens, but also understands that the state is endowed with a monopoly on coercive force, and that force needs to be used in a very constrained way, because with great power comes great responsibility. So you can think of it in terms of four Ds: development, so developing the capacity of the police, so investigative resources, boots on the ground, visible policing is very effective. Then decentralization, as I mentioned, so empowering other organs of not only the government, but also of society to have policing powers. So back in the day, we used to have the commando unit, which was responsible for rural safety. That was disbanded for political reasons.
By Mbeki in 2006.
Yeah, and that was very effective at dealing with the very complex dynamics of rural safety. Now you have civil society organizations like AfriForum coming together on a voluntary basis, pooling their resources, and actually dealing with issues like the pandemic of farm attacks that we have in the country. So civil society organizations have a big role to play. I've already spoken about the role that opposition government entities, like in the Western Cape, the city of Cape Town, can play, pushing the envelope, not asking for permission, rather seeking forgiveness retrospectively, and saying, okay, well, we're gonna, if there's no ballistics functioning system in the Western Cape, we're going to create our own one, and that's going to help with prosecutions. If the NPA is not going to prosecute cases, we're going to do private prosecutions. So decriminalization is another D. That means looking at areas of the economy where there are supposedly, or how you would say, victimless crimes. So if you're at home smoking and your home is deemed to be a place of work because you join a Zoom call every day, and the state wants to ban you from doing that, you say, no, this is not your domain, government. This is my domain, my private property rights. You don't have dominion here. This is not appropriate. If a restaurant wants to have a smoking area that's well ventilated for the smoking customers, that's separate from the non-smoking customers, then that's their right to do that as a business owner. So these are the kinds of strategies that we need to employ. Decriminalizing the economy. The state is incapable of dealing with real crime like violence and theft and murder and rape and all these things, but is busy being this busybody, nanny state kind of interfering actor that's actually getting in the way of productive people leading their lives. So that's where the focus should be, on the real violent crime issues, and not on policing a non-violent commerce and other activity.
Thank you very much, David. Khulekani.
So I want to say three things. Firstly, I disagree with David that you do not need a state. I mean, he didn't say so in so many words. Countries that function, you go anywhere in the world, there is an effective government that will check you as you enter the port of entry, check everything, satisfy itself that it has all the necessary details that you should be here, and actually takes the responsibility of safeguarding its citizens seriously everywhere else. So rather than saying that we need a government that sort of leaves citizens to get on with it, we just need a functional government that does the things that governments are supposed to do. And yes, leave business to do what business does and so on, but do the things that our government functions effectively. I don't want that message to be missed or lost. That's one. Two, the illicit economy cannot be a solution to our high unemployment in the country. In fact, it adds to it and more. If everybody made sure that every cigarette that South Africans continue to smoke is produced legally, that creates jobs. Every bottle of alcohol or can is produced legally, legitimately, that creates jobs. Clothes, everything. The fact that you have this underground is what adds to our problem. So again, we should not forgive, we should not justify the illicit economy. It is actually our enemy in the fight against crime, in the fight against risks to health, etc., etc. And finally, an answer to Dave, to Chad's question, why are things still functioning, you know, despite all of these things that are happening? Two things. One, I think the question has been answered. Actually, South Africans in their different formations, whether they are civil society formations or just as individuals, are the reason we're still standing. So I take you back to the story that I've told. It took South Africans standing up in with their nopkiris and going to watch their towns and shops and so on. Of course, the police started coming in. So South Africans, when they realized that this hurt us, we won't have anywhere to buy bread tomorrow if we allow this to happen, they stand up. And this is why things still function despite all of what's happening. So actually, we need to mobilize South Africans to, you know, pull their sleeves up, work to fix this country in all aspects. We're doing our bit in business. We have a work stream where we try to work with government on solving the crime issue. A small piece of it, and we're seeing some improvements. And it just shows that if we play our part as citizens, play our part as business, we can actually turn things around rather than put our hands up.
Do you think government's playing its part, though?
Okay, can I answer those two before I leave? Okay. Let me answer to the two questions, to the lady. We have incredible symbiotic cohesiveness between the private security industry and the police at the moment. The police have acknowledged, it's not a cop-out on their part, they've acknowledged they need the assistance of the private sector. Business Against Crime South Africa has established the E2 project, very successful project. The police are sharing war rooms with security companies, there's joint operational commands, and you'll see security companies taking part in operations with the police. And it's been formalized, it's an actual partnership. With regards to where we're falling short in the police, it's not force multipliers. It's not putting more boots on the ground. It's having experienced, trained detectives. Without detectives, you can't get a docket enrolled in court because a prosecutor won't enroll a docket if there's no prospect of a successful prosecution. So we're falling short that Operation Shanela arrested 600,000 people to date. We don't have 600,000 people in our prisons. We've got 140,000 people in our prisons. So it's a turnstile at the police station. Somebody's arrested, they're released. Arrested or released because they aren't detectives. So we need more of the private sector skills in the short term to capacitate the state until the state can roll out medium and long-term policing plans. To your point, I'm guessing you're a Charlie Kirk supporter. I'm not. But that's you. I can see it. I can see it written all over your face. I was really proud of our country when we went to the ICJ. I was exceptionally proud. Somebody had to do that. We weren't paid by Iran to do that. That's bullshit. Absolute bullshit. We did it because when the ANC were fighting in the trenches, they were fighting alongside the IRA, they were fighting alongside the PLO, and they made a commitment, all these freedom fighting organizations, to support one another. Yeah, the ANC's fallen off its track, but at least that's one thing they did that I'm proud of. I may not be proud of a lot of our leaders and what's happened in our country, but the fact that they want to hold people to account for what's clearly a genocide according to the United Nations today, good for South Africa. Our media, my God, we have a fiercely independent media. They've held politicians to account, criminals to account. They're the ones that are constantly going at all the bad guys. There's not a book that doesn't come out that isn't a bestseller where they're exposing people, whether it's Daily Maverick, Scorpio, Amabungane. There are so many independent media houses that are striving and fighting towards keeping our democracy free and fair. With regards to Section 9s, they're trying their best. Yeah, some of them have been politicized, some of them have been captured, but there's a lot. I can name a lot for you. There's the Public Protector, there's the Equality Commission, there's, like you pointed out, the HRC. There's multiple. We as South Africans have our own set of problems. And when you come here and you tell us that our media is not fair or our media is not free, I'm going to say to you which media in the world is. The Citizen newspaper was started by the Nats in the 1970s to try to bring the English whites to vote for the Nats. You go to America, CNN is Democrat, Fox is outwardly Republican. So don't come tell me our media has a problem when the country you love so much, America, is most probably the most biased in the world.
Okay. We don't have any time left. Chad, I'd like you to thank you for the extra 15 minutes. Thank you to Kulegane Mate, thank you to David Ansara, and thank you to all of you for your questions. If they didn't get answered, apologies, go watch the video and maybe comment. Hopefully they'll watch it as well and respond there. But thank you very much for joining us, and I hope as you guys go home, you'll go home safely. Please try and take this, I think this piece of advice from David, and also Kulegane echoing it. We need to do something ourselves where we see there's a moral decay and we see that maybe the state is failing in some way, whether it's private companies, whether it's the individual. I think each of us can do something. Thank you very much. Yeah.